Oh, you prayed for a long time.
Then there was also concern, I think, from the MPA that the mandate should be focused, and the concern was that new units would be sought with work that could be dealt with in another way.
Started this case, all you knew about was 10,000 rand. be able to say that investigation, when it started, was illegal. It was outside of your mandate and therefore illegal. The approach in the DSO was from the beginning to have very clear internal guidelines to say what are the kind of cases we're going to look at. But they're not guidelines that end up limiting or being able to be challenged legally about whether you have the legal power to investigate certain things. So I think the correct approach here is to have a mandate that is relatively wide, but perhaps combine it with this idea that internally the organization will have guidelines about the kinds of cases that it should take on. But it, you know, one wants to phrase that in a way that it's flexible. 10 years ago, nobody thought abalone smuggling was a problem. Today, it's a big problem. So, you know, I think what you do need to ensure that the organization itself, subject to whatever oversight mechanisms one has, but one is able to adjust your focus to some extent to the changing nature of organized crime. I think the second issue that I think is similar to what Johan was saying now is that a key part of a mandate for me is a play, you know, it's essentially, I suppose, where is it important to use this integrated methodology? You know, and I think that is ultimately what becomes practically your mandate. You know, where is it not sufficient for an ordinary detective working with an ordinary prosecutor in a normal course of events? Where does your cases become of a complexity where that model is not good enough and where you need a more integrated model? And that is more an issue of, you know, it's difficult to define that exactly legally. I think the third issue that I wanted just to say is that I think the law should be more explicit here on the issue of complex economic crime, and that would include the issue of complex corruption. You know, at the moment, those things are only added in the proclamations, and it is perhaps important that there's a mechanism to add to the legal mandate or to change it through proclamations. But I think the Act itself should have those two or three focus areas fairly specifically spelled out, but not too narrowly, as I was saying earlier.
Okay, your comments are on the tracker methodology. Okay, members, are there any input maybe? Honourable Jubel?
So could you just explain to us the proclamations, the function of the proclamation, and how does it work in practice?
I think the law, the NPA Act, just made provision that apart from what is specified in the law as the mandate, the President by proclamation may add further focus areas. So, you know, from at the time, you'll remember that the DSO was formed out of the IDOCs, the Investigating Directorates on Organized Crime, and ITSEO, the Investigating Directorate of Serious Economic Crime. Their mandates were already defined by proclamation, and essentially those proclamations were kept in place, particularly because it was important for continuity, for the transition from the old bodies to the new. And I think that is, again, something that this law will have to look at. You know, it's not very strong on transitional mechanisms at the moment, but where does the cases, the powers that have been exercised in the past, how do they transition into the new body? I think that does need some care, and I think it's important to look at the transition mechanisms that there are at the moment in the NPA Act to cater for the previous transition. We'll probably need a lot of those similar provisions in terms of the new Act to cater for the transition to the new dispensation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I think in you know, the mandate, I think the Chairperson also wrote it yesterday, we agree that we need to broaden the mandate and we need to look at it, and it's one of the things that we have to discuss. I think in terms of the first two issues under the mandate, we've already established yesterday that the DSO was in fact not responsible for police corruption, as was the perception. community being raised as well. And but that does not take away from the fact that I think we must use this opportunity to look at the corruption issue within SAPS, whether we are satisfied with it being in the places where it is currently, as explained by Commissioner Jacobs, and that we maybe address that as well. The last thing that I think is important as well, I mean, when the Honourable Huber now asked for, you know, for explanation of the proclamations, I think for us to have a full understanding of the capacity or the mandate of the ICD, we must actually get a copy of the mandate of the proclamation in terms of the mandate. Only, you know, the proclamation in terms of the mandate, I would personally think it would be helpful for us if we can have a copy of that so that we can understand the extent of the mandate and see where we want to place that as well.
Members, is there any input, maybe comments, while we are still on the mandate?
Thank you, Chairperson. I did understand that the TSO was not supposed to investigate the police and so on. But I'm not quite sure what are we going to do about it, because there are so many crooks. Not all of them. But what do we do with that? Where do you locate that? Because some of the units have been disbanded and so on. What do we do with that? What are we looking at? I'm not saying this new unit should do that and so on. But what do we do with people that are really?
What's the budget?
I'm asking Commissioner Jacobs to respond to it.
You can come.
Jay, no, I think there are mechanisms. If a person is being convicted of any crime, there is no place for him in certain instances where for the police to place him somewhere. Jay, as I've said, the police corruption. Investigation thereof presently is done by members in the anti-corruption in the organized crime units, and the capacity has been established for that in the organized crime units.
Hello, can I want to come in?
Chairperson, I think what we're saying is that we need to look at it. We don't have the answer. Are we happy? Are we happy with it being in the organized crime unit? Are we happy with it being part of the ordinary crime investigations of the detective services? Or do we want to have a specific unit, an internal affairs, if you want to call it that, or whatever else you want to call it, to deal with police corruption and to specifically be mandated to look at police corruption? The fact of the matter is we have the opportunity now. We might as well use it to do so. And again, it comes back to the argument that we've made previously as well. If we enact it, nobody can just simply remove it again. Can decide it's not necessary to have it.
Yeah. Can I just add something, Kochi? At least covered what I've said. I really think whatever we decide about the future of the Scorpions, this issue needs to be addressed in our report. While we're at it, you know, I just want to ask, why would you, it can come up later, but very quickly, since you read, why did you dissolve the anti-corruption unit in 2002? And why would you put the corruption capacity such as it exists within the organized crime unit? Because police people are corrupt, if they are, not just around organized crime issues, but there might be ordinary individual corruption, you know, which I think is probably the more higher proportion of the cases you have. So the second thing is also, I think we need to firstly clarify that are we all agreeing that it's not the task of the Scorpions or the new unit to deal with police corruption? Are we agreeing on that? If that's the case, then we're agreeing that we don't think, well, the safety and security people know more, that you in the SAPS are fully equipped to deal with corruption within the SAPS, and in that regard, if that's what we agree, we want to know what structure should exist, what we can propose. Now, there are limits to what Parliament can say to the executive about internal structural arrangements, unless you have a bill before you and so on, but we can propose in a report to Parliament, or if we want it stronger, I don't know, we can think of some stronger form of doing that. But why did you dissolve the corruption, anti-corruption?
Chair, I think when I explained you, we're just outside the moment. I'll be very short. There was inadequate capacity at that stage regarding corruption, and we realized that the biggest problem was police corruption within the organized crime context. So we focused that, and by placing that capacity within organized crime, we were able to do it, and in the meantime, that capacity was strengthened by means of training, and so to equip actually all organized crime unit members to deal with corruption. So in that way, it was expanded, but on the other corruption, that in civil society, that's normally investigated by the commercial crime, because very often it's within the commercial crime environment anyway. So that was basically the rationale. And in addition, within the restructuring of detective service, we are revisiting the issue. And I think what Ms. Van Baker said is very true. If we look at the issue now, it is worthwhile to look at it in the broader context and see within the restructuring process as well what will be the best option.
Question, since you dissolved the anti-corruption unit and moved the major part of it into the OCU, have you seen a significant improvement in your combating and preventing corruption within the SAPS? And if so, can you provide us statistics next week? Can I suggest also procedurally, the two researchers are meant to collate a report that derives from these deliberations. So we're not going to cover the same ground again. What Christine and Mpiti are going to say, these are the 20 issues that, out of these deliberations, that we feel need to be addressed when we meet with you again in open committee. But before then, the questions that we've asked Christine and Mpiti that they respond to next week, you'll let them have by tomorrow morning. And you'll let the members have as well. So when they come in next week, we say, hey, these are the 20 questions, respond now. Okay.
Chair, I would prefer to get some statistics on that rather than do some thumb-sucking, but I believe there were actually serious problems with the anti-corruption units themselves, and in some instances even corruption within the unit. So I think that was one, and I think that it was a problem that, or some perceptions about the if I can say, the old specialized units. So there was a huge restructuring of specialized units as such, as the Safety and Security Committee will well know. But I think if we look at these statistics, I'm quite sure there was quite an improvement, but I would rather rely on exact figures and so than just give a perception to you.
What's the meaning of this uses an outdated definition of organized crime that is contained in the NPA Act? It's submitted by JASA.
Chair, I think the issues mentioned in Section 16 at the moment, when Section 16 was drafted, it was very much along the lines of those existing initial specialized units. But I think those areas still cover the issues that we are involved in organized crime. And not only organized crime, because Section 16 was also directed at crimes where you need specialized attention or special skills, or where there are international implications. So Section 16 is not directed only at organized crime. But I think it covers the areas that we still experience within the organized crime environment, and with the adding of the definition of serious offense from the RICA Act, it was actually even broadened. But Chair, as I've mentioned this, I realize that we need to sort of streamline it, and I'm in total agreement that we should not have arguments about mandate when it comes to the application of this Act. It should be very clear and broad enough to cover issues that we need to investigate without it having been challenged later in court. Thank you, Chair.
If I can just mention a couple of points. The first one is that the existing proclamations of the DSO is in the NPA submission in Annexure A2, if the committee section, the researchers can maybe just circulate it to members, but it's on pages 53 to 57.
Circulated to members.
Yeah, it's already with them. The second point is, I think that what is less clear to us at the moment, whether it's it is conceived that the whole of commercial crime or organized crime is going into the new unit, or, you know, at the moment the bill talks about selected members. But clearly, if most or even a part, you know, even a substantial part of those units are going into the new units, the issue of the anti-corruption capability in organized crime and the commercial crime mandate within commercial crime needs to be reflected in the new unit as well as the the commercial crime mandate to look at corruption broader than, I mean, elsewhere in government or in the private sector. So I think those issues do need to be clarified and covered. I think I don't think we have strong views about whether a new unit should be responsible for looking at all corruption within the police, let's say. I think that's an issue that should be debated, as has been said. But the other point that I wanted to add is that looking at corruption within the new unit is going to be vital as well. Now, I think that was to some extent a problem in the DSO, that there was pretty rigorous screening about bringing people into the organization, but it was assumed that once you've had your security screening and so on, that you will remain clean for the next 5 years. And I think the law, we really should consider in the law whether there should not be even provision for enhanced internal integrity measures to which, beyond the normal screening, to which members of this unit should be subject. Because as soon as you start dealing with very rich criminals, the risks of corruption is significantly increased. You know, we recently had a case, I think we're working with the police on it, where people were offered a 10, 15 million rand bribe. Now, for somebody who may not earn a tenth of that in their whole career, those are very big amounts of money, and we have to make sure that the new unit is kept clean. Health just cannot do its work.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe just two issues going from the provincial visits that we had that I think we need to flag. The first being on police corruption. When we went to the provinces, there seems to be a perception amongst people that the ICD looks at police corruption. I think it's important to clarify the fact that the ICD looks at general complaints and misconduct. There has to be a specific complaint. It's not that the ICD looks at police corruption proactively, and I don't think you can rely on the ICD to look at police corruption. That being the first thing. And then the second thing, I also believe that the mandate should be flexible enough because types of criminal activity could change, and something that may be a priority now may not be a priority in 5 years' time or vice versa. The issue which did come up at the provincial visits was this process of defining and deciding which types of crimes will be a priority. What sort of process are we going to use to define priority crimes?
So it takes us back to the model that we're talking about, that all of those, the mandate and all the things, it should be inside of the model, what kind of animal we want to create, we want to put on the feathers. Are there any comments on mandate?
I think I'll follow what Anani has said, which Commissioner Jacobs agree that let us not debate the matter now, but let us open up and see and flag it, because we may come up with something else, because I don't believe that there are no criminals within the police, so there are no crooks within the police. As I've just said, that if you offer me 15 million, I can kill you really for 15 million. But now, you're good. I'm just making an example. Something like that, if we can just
could do is, can you give us a text of how you think we could, or is there already an amendment you've suggested in your concrete amendment? Or do you want to fine-tune it? What I'm trying to say is that, yeah, and then we'll see what the FAPF thinks of it, and what DOG thinks of it, and what the committees think of it. We can refer it to Enver as well. But the issue of a mandate being clear, although not binding, so that it keeps account as the characters of the changing nature of organized crime, this is crucial. I mean, you know, it's like a cardinal sort of pivotal thing. So we have to get it right.
Sorry, Chair, if I can just say, I think the fact that Section 16 is not reflected in the text of the bill, and the fact that the definition of serious offence is just mentioned in the bill, caused a lot of confusion on what the mandate is. In effect, if you would analyse it, you will find a lot of commonality between Section 7 in the NPA Act and the way in which Section 16 is structured. That's why I say I think things as they are now are not user-friendly. And I think much of the process will be to sort of clear that up and have a text that is clear to everyone. If you read it, that you understand what's in the text itself and not go and search for it elsewhere.
I just want to get a clarity as we are trying to establish the new model. I'm trying to establish who will be investigating the new strategy, the DPSCI, because they must also be falling into a trap like what the Scorpions have called into trap. And then let me say the brown mouse. They sound just like a name to other people. But if you look deeply into that report, this could have been have a serious repercussion in this country. A war could have broken out. It was dividing people. It was dwelling into the security of the country. It was serious. It needed to be investigated and so on. But now, who should be doing it in this new structure to solve that? Because so that it can be attended. How do we build that?
So, it's the same point Governor Marks is making, that I really think we should put something more firm in the law. If we go for this new unit, that there must be beyond screening. I never came across this term before, but advanced integrity measures. Now, I think we want a clause like that. So, you know, Commissioner Jacobs, I don't think we can discuss anything. Even if we want the scorpions back, that will apply. So some things we can agree on right now. And so can the committee researchers note this, right? There are some things I'm thinking more and more. We don't have to discuss whether we want the scorpions or not. If we want the scorpions, we also want to put some things in. Now, this will be one thing we have to put in. The NPA itself is saying they need it, and we agree. And so that's me agreeing on. So can they start working over this weekend on text? The second thing to say is, I know Commissioner Phillips came to me one day when the public hearings were in civil. Actually, it's all there. Now, just to tell you, well, at least on the justice side, we constantly tell justice, no, you're drafting for the average person out there. And we in committees that I've served before, we don't accept that argument. If it's not clear to the MPs who are applying their mind daily to it, then it's not acceptable. So, and interestingly, here's a man who played a major role in, what was it, writing simple, plain language writing. So, you know, he must play a great other hat and help. But the bill is, you know, I've read it 3 times. It's not clear. It's really well, let me be blunt. Would you respect, because now we are joint committees, I would have said it to your DOG official. It's not a good bill. It's a badly written bill, actually. And that's my view as a chair of the committee. And it's got to be made simpler. And you could start working on it now if you really think you want to move faster on the bill. That's my view. And I think it's consistent with the way the Justice Study Group approaches bills. It's a badly written bill, actually.
Okay, can I just add on the point that was raised over here? You know, I think the proper effective oversight for this body is vital. So I think it's also the point here is, I think it was a weakness with the DSO. That I think 4 years ago there was proposals to make the DSO subject.
ICD must have its normal oversight role as well. I don't think anybody objects to that, but you know, I think our position is just when you're dealing with high risk investigation areas, the unit itself must have a much more proactive and intensive integrity process within the unit. It can't just rely on oversight. It must have its own mechanisms to ensure that it's safe.
Then I suppose that maybe we get into other sub-item, the integrated methodology.
Just for the sake of the coaching, I'm just worried Commissioner Jacobs might ignore all the requests made to him because you keep on calling him Commissioner Phillips. Philip Jacobs.
Problem is he uses the first name. That's why I should. And now
he's using the first
serial killer,
we will use the services of a psychologist to draw up a profile of the suspect, etc., etc. So you need a lot of expertise in many different types of cases, and we support the use of any type of expertise that you need for a specific investigation, including the legal expertise of a prosecutor. And although I think you can have in-house law advisors who can assist the police, there's somewhere along the line that the function must go over to the to a prosecutor. A prosecutor cannot be replaced by in-house legal advisor. They can play a role, they do play a role every day, but we recognize that we need the assistance within the context of serious crime. And we have a system in place at the moment where projects are identified within the organized crime context, and where the NPA actually designates the prosecutors who work with the investigation. So it's not something new, it's not something that we do not do, and it's not something that we are opposed to. But once again, that line that must be drawn, and the fact that we feel that those people should not be in the employ of the same employer. Thanks.
In other words, I just wanted to check, you saying that there was a submission from Helen Suzman, IDASA, and the other ones, and the concern group, saying that the Troika methodology results in increased respect and understanding between discipline, creating a unified approach and a good teamwork. So what are you saying on that one?
Same thing I wanted to ask. Can you explain to us why you say having the prosecutors and the investigators in the same unit is not good? Same point by Coach Jason. Can you explain to us why? Secondly, can you tell us why, even if you believe that, which you obviously do, why you haven't set out in the bill very clearly that though you don't think they should be in the same unit, you think that they should work together? Where is that in the bill? Because I read the bill twice and peripherally the other day while sitting in a meeting. I couldn't see that. I remember Carol coming to your rescue, I cannot for the last inquiry, and saying, it doesn't have to be law, it can be a policy decision. So presumably that's your answer. But she was really coming to your rescue, I think, and being kind to you. But the truth is, that may be her view, and she's entitled to it, but I can also ask, why do you want it as a policy? Why, if you see it's about organized crime, and why, if you know the increasing norm is for prosecutors and investigators to work together, why haven't you got it at least that they can be seconded and clearer? So the two issues are related.
Good job. I think it also relates to other disciplines and not necessarily only prosecutors, because I've heard some views that you should place people from SARS and from different institutions within this unit, and then they must retain the powers that they have in terms of the legislation of the mother department, and that will increase the powers of such a unit. But I think it once again boils down to a question of accountability. Because if I have powers that another minister is actually responsible for, and I start exercising that powers within totally another institution under another direction and command, etc. And I think that's where the present problem lies with the issue about the prosecutor and investigator within the context of the DSA. It all boils down to accountability and retaining that degree of objectivity that is required from a prosecutor, for example. And Chair, there was another question relating to the secondment. I think Commissioner Fivers mentioned that there must be a very strong secondment provision in order to sort of being able to force other institutions to second people. But I think it's contrary to the whole concept of secondment of people. Normally you can't force people to be seconded into another unit, and I think you shouldn't be in a position to force other departments second the officials to you. It's really creating a lot of conflict even before you've started.
Can I just play the role of a coach here, right, to facilitate? It's facilitation, we're coming to you. You're not being clear to us. That's our job as coaches, right? So we're not making points to it. It's on clarity. You're saying the reason you don't have it in the bill is because inevitably you put a clause in the bill, you're forcing people to second.
One could argue precisely because you don't think it's easy to second, you have to put it in the book if you believe it, because otherwise people are not going to do it. They'll do it less even if you don't have it in the book, point one. Point two is, surely it depends on the content of your provision in the bill that will determine whether you're forcing people or not. For example, one can put it, the, you know, gently, but at least you have a notion in the bill of what's the word, secondment, right? It's the way you do it, not whether you do it, that's the issue. There was a third thing that struck me that's not making sense, actually, and it's not consistent. Where you expecting to secure secondment outside of a specific and explicit and clear provision in the bill? Fourthly, why do you speak? It's something interesting I've only discovered. Maybe you are right, and maybe Edward can help us on this as an independent state law advisor. You see, they say things like, I've heard this before for the first time in some other context, and I was a bit confused. They say things like, if you bring people from different departments, problems of accountability arise because the legislation applies to that department. But I thought once a law is passed, it applies to government as a whole. What we do is to execute those powers that are provided in legislation. We have departments to do so. But it's not such a thing as, if I take somebody from SARS, then SARS will come with the laws that apply to SARS. Those laws apply across the country, across the government departments. And they present that as an argument about why it's difficult to coordinate the different units from different departments. There is something else that struck me about coordination. When Willie spoke, I really think one should be wary about having this new unit, if that's the route we go in, the DPCI, and also have other units that are also dealing with similar things. You see, it seems to me, now this I have no mandate for, I'm just throwing it out to facilitate. I'm not speaking on behalf of the majority party. Let me stress that I'm not speaking on behalf of the majority party. I am not speaking on behalf of the majority party. I am playing a facilitating role, and this is the view of a chairperson for the members of the committee to think about. It's not a position of the ANC. May I stress it's not a position of the ANC because the journalist concerned is here. May I stress that it's not a position of the ANC, but the point is, don't we want to think about this? Don't we want to think about this? That if we decide to go for a new unit, we do not want to have other units within the SAPS, okay, that are overlapping with it, because we're back to square one. That we have too many units now. All that's happened is they've been taken from different areas and put into one sort of overall SAPS. Is that something members want to think about? That if crime is dealt with by one unit within SAPS, so be it. And where it links to organized crime, corruption is dealt with by one unit, or if corruption related to organized crime is dealt with, it must be dealt with by the DPCI. But we don't want overlapping. Is that what we more or less teaching towards saying? Okay, is that something we'll apply our mind to? Okay. So can you answer those four questions?
Chair, I think you've asked whether it should not be in the law before this set of questions. As a matter of fact, when we drafted, we actually tinkered around with a lot of ideas, because you get a lot of terminology. Some people talk about prosecution guided, some about prosecution led. Anthony Altbecker used the term prosecution serviced. And it seemed to me with all those terminology, eventually we ended up with using something like court directed, and then it sounded as if the court will direct the investigation. Whereas we meant that it should be with a view to a proper case in court. I think it's difficult to really, and I think it's not only about prosecution guided and led and what it is. It's about that multidisciplinary approach where you use different disciplines within the investigation. So I want to say I think it's quite difficult to reflect it in law, and I don't think, I think if you accept that is the methodology that you will use, it can take many forms. I mean, how many are you going to write in, how many of which disciplines or whatever, it can take many forms. About the secondment, there is a secondment provision. All I said that we must be
very careful on how it is structured to keep it within the present framework of how the continent works in public service. Okay, I don't know if I have answered your question. Is that
a related question? You know, would it not be true to say, I'm sorry, I'm just clarifying, okay? I'm going to stop now, because I don't know where I can take further. But the point I want to make is, you see this thing about you saying, if we have a prosecutor referred to in the bill, like whether you're prosecutor guided or prosecutor, then what about the SARS person and the committee's edging towards saying, what about immigration and so on? But isn't there a specific case to be made for prosecutors? Because they will finally take a case to court. So you can't equate them with the SARS person, with the immigration person and the FICA person. Would that not be a reasonable thing to say, that you can't equate? Why are we concerned about prosecutors? It's because they finally play such a decisive role in the matter getting to court. And can I suggest, Conway Coche, something I have raised in the study group. To be quite frank, I have read the literal submissions. I've read your overview up to page 82, and I got stopped there. That's because of other things. But I've literally read about 40% of the submissions. And I must say, the strongest argument that comes out is the one about integrated methodology. It is very difficult, actually, when you look at both sides of the argument, to be fair, to contest it, you know. I mean, I'm trying to even rationalize some of what some of my comrades say. And it's really hard. It's very hard because the most compelling argument presented is the one of why you need the prosecutor from day one. So I really feel that, you know, comrade co-chair, I think this is a matter that's going to preoccupy a lot of time on the subcommittee. But to be fair, let me ask you a question. Isn't the prosecutor, all the same people that say bring in SARS and immigration, they focus mainly on the prosecutor. Isn't that because the prosecutor is a distinct category that has to play a role as part of a coordination process?
To ensure that what is presented in court will stand in court. I agree with you, and that's why I say within the Troika, the prosecutor, investigating, intelligence, they are the main role players. And the prosecutor is important, and that's what I'm saying all along, and he can be brought on board on an early stage. All I'm saying that we need to protect the independence of the prosecutor and his role, and we can use, and I can mention the example of the Serious Economic Offences Unit. It functioned exactly that way. At an early stage, a prosecutor is designated to investigation, he runs with the investigator, and when that case is finished, another case is designated to him, or he might be responsible for a number of cases. So, as I'm saying, I'm not opposed to the idea of having a prosecutor involved. All I'm saying, they need to not be employed by the same employer.
Final thing, just to pull it together. I think what we're saying, based on our discussion last week, right, is that one is we're not happy with what's here in the bill. We think there should be a more explicit provision, especially in the case of prosecutors. Whether we want the scorpions or we don't, I think we're all agreeing that prosecutors are important. Those of us who want scorpions dissolved are saying not that prosecutors shouldn't play a role, but that they should play it without being in the same unit. And in that regard, we're mandating you and Johanya and whoever wants to work, the research unit, to look at the UK and other models, Norwegian model and so on. Can you start doing that, please? It's quite important to actually look at how prosecutors can play a role without being located within it. Now, those who want the scorpions retained, can I put a challenge to you? Given the strong feelings of the majority party on this issue, if you want to retain the scorpions, why don't you think about how we can change the current methodology of the DSO, if that's the correct word? Have another form of an integrated methodology. Now, one example thrown out by technical experts is, there's something, I don't know, Commissioner, but there's something about an investigative prosecutor. The person who works closely with the case is not the same person that decides whether the case be taken to court and how prosecutable it is. So you've got a term, I don't know where I got this from, but somewhere in my notes and my scrolls I found something called investigating prosecutor and prosecutorial prosecutor. Does it make any sense to you? Somewhere I picked that up, okay? So that's another option. So those of you who don't want the scorpions to go, the challenge to you is to help to
sort of have some slight separation of the prosecutor takes the case to court and the one that works with the investigator from day one, or some idea of a separation. For those of us who want the scorpions to go, we have the challenge, or you have the challenge, to actually, I know why you're laughing, Baba and Globu. You have the challenge. Yeah. You have the challenge. Schizophrenic, is that the word? You have the challenge of saying, okay, you don't want the prosecutors to be located in the same unit, then tell us how you're going to get the prosecutors to work with the investigators. Taking into account some of the things the commissioner has said, it's difficult to get people to cooperate. If people are not in the same unit, others have argued, there's lots of arguments. I mean, you know, about the wonderful explanation Willie gave us and Steve Swart picked up. He said, actually, often in the, both of them said, often today in these cases, it's not the criminals on trial. Something I'm learning from you guys, right? So I'm stuttering and stumbling for the word. You said something about the investigation goes on trial, isn't it? It's a wonderful, evocative way of explaining what you're saying. And people look at the quality of what you did. Did you get the warrants at the right time? Did you secure the warrants within the context of the law? Did you brief the person you suspect of his or her rights appropriately and so on? Somebody uses an example of you can get 40,000 pages of notes, and 2 years later it's brought to your desk as a prosecutor. And you start from square one, and then you say, no, but of these 40,000, 13,000 are not something you need. You need another 12,000 and go back and so on. So the time you start the case, the time you finalize the case, it's even more torturous for those of us who complain about how the DSO has been treating people. 5 years later, they don't even know whether they're still being proceeded against or not. So can we also have members who want the scorpions dissolved to think about that? So that's where we go. But we all agree. I think that's what I'll start. All agreeing that there's a need for the role of prosecutors. The question is the form. Comrade Kocha, I just withdraw, and I noticed the two of them had their hands up. Carol and Adam.
I had my own list. That's the problem of court hearing with you.
Oh, sorry.
I noticed Honorable Joubert. I recognize Honorable Joubert, noticed Honorable Fadwick.
Thank you, Chair. Yesterday, the co-chair referred to the UK and Swedish or Norwegian models, and he also asked the researchers to look at it, but I'm sure Commissioner Jacob Stamps must have looked at this. Can't you just tell us in short what those models entail?
Chair, as a matter of fact, when the Gampepe Commission was ongoing, there was a lot of research done into it. Of course, some things have changed to some extent. But if I can mention the Australian example, there was even a court case in Australia on whether the prosecutor may give legal advice to the investigator before the case is presented to the prosecutor for decision. Now, in that case, it was found that it can be done and so on. But I also, at this stage, and I haven't updated all the research on that, last night I went through a number of things and as I said, it's quite clear. If you look, especially in the European Union, they've done a lot of research on the powers of the prosecutors, and especially in Europe, it was interesting that they looked at it within the context also of police powers that are actually increasing in respect of less serious cases. But the conclusion that was made that was the direction of the prosecution. Is especially important in respect of serious cases. And then one statement that was made as well in one of the documents is that sometimes you will look at legislation, but the actual position on the ground differs, although the position of the prosecutor might seem to be quite strong. On the ground, it's not necessarily the fact, and that's just a practical issue in the sense that the databases and the information and everything is with the police. And the decision that the prosecutor might make is very much influenced by what is given to the police and what is held back by the police, etc., etc. So, but all I can say, maybe in general, it differs from country to country and the, between the civil law system and the other system. So, but there is recognition. And as I said, there are some countries where the police services actually fall within justice and would fall under the prosecution. So I can't argue and say the fact that prosecutors can direct investigations is something that's unacceptable or whatever. If you would do comparative legal research, you will find even in the documentation of the there's a society that they've, or a body of prosecutors where they've laid down certain guidelines, etc. And they always make provision for countries which have both systems of involvement of prosecutors. But I think what also comes through very, very clearly is the fact that the prosecutor must remain objective, and that within the whole process of being investigated or being involved in investigations, that he must be able to look at his primary role of prosecution and retain that objectivity to make decisions that are not driven by success or, in some documents even mentioned, media pressure. Chair, I don't want to preempt what the researchers can do. As I said, some research that we have done within the SAPS might be outdated at this stage, and maybe I can be accused of not being objective myself. But as I said, I'm quite frank. If you ask me on an academic level, what is the recognition of that? Both systems are recognized in the world. In some countries, like India, for example, there's the prosecution is very much part of the police. And a system which is criticized very widely, but it can swing both ways. But there is recognition for both systems, and in some countries the powers of the prosecutor is quite strong in respect of directing investigations.
Thank you, Jay. I think we should go on a study tour before we can find out.
Maybe before, I just want to suggest that maybe we take all the questions as the hand has noted, then before Yama responds, so that you could be able to be quick. And also I want to recognize the visitors, the students of the gallery. We are here in joint meeting with Safety and Security and Justice on the deliberations on the two bills, National Prosecuting Authority Bill and the SAPS Amendment Bill. I've recognized Honorable Annelies.
Chairperson, yes, I think one of the issues that also comes that has come to my mind, I think, is we need to get some clarity on as well, but I think it will be influenced in the end also by the model we take, is if we talk about secondment, are we talking on a case-to-case basis? Are we talking about a longer-term secondment? And that applies to the prosecutors, I believe, as well. Because, for instance, if we take a practical example, let's say there's a corruption case involving the Department of Home Affairs. They've got their own, I think they call it the Integrity Unit, that investigates corruption in Home Affairs. It now results in criminal case, etc. Are we going to second those people from the Integrity Unit in Home Affairs to work together with the investigators in this unit? And is the secondment going to be for the period of time until this case goes to court? I mean, those are issues I think we still also need to clarify. Are we talking about secondment on a case-to-case basis? Are we talking of secondment if we talk about SARS and all these people on a more permanent basis? I don't know. I mean, I'm not clear on that. And that, to me, I think is something that we need to look at. Maybe what we need is both. Maybe we want certain expertise on a more permanent basis, but we also want to make provision for secondment on specific issues. For instance, immigration integrity unit at Home Affairs become part of a specific case for a period of time. That's the one thing. If I can just say also, I think it's very important that we do have some more detailed explanations of what is available out there. If, for instance, you look at the UK, the unit they call themselves the high-tech crime unit, in the UK. It's such a small unit, but it works with secondment of people that have got expertise people from the Navy, the SAPs or their SAPs, intelligence, all of them only having one specialized skill, and that skill is computers, to conduct the investigations they are doing. But again, you know, there are certain things that come into that, that it's for a specific case, it's for a specific period. And I think we definitely need what you've been asking for, a bit more about what is available out there. But I would just like to put on the table that I think we might want to look at making provision for both, seconding for a specific case, but then seconding on a more ongoing period.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. I think I will go along with what analysis is saying. Because in the unit, you need to have a specialist. You need to have people who are there constantly to monitor and see how things are going and so on and so forth. But you need to have a specialist too, where we are saying you brought a person from SAS to deal with this case until the case goes to court, and then thereafter release them. But there it goes back to money again, coordination again. That person has to make sure that the money he gets there, he doesn't get it from the mother body, because that's where the problem lies. You can succumb the person if the money is not clear. At the end of the day, it goes back, or it comes to him, his or her money, and then it confuses the situation. Therefore, if we're talking about specialized cases, we must deal with specialized cases and the money. It should be clear on that. But we need to have specialized people within the unit that will be there, employed permanently there to drive the unit.
Michelle?
Shepherdson, why the bill might not necessarily mention all the specialized units? We believe that the role of the prosecutors must be very clearly stated in the bill. While many people question the success of the Scorpions, which many believe it was based on their Tarka approach, we still believe that the new unit will have to be prosecution-led. Now, the Commissioner made a statement that if you have investigators and prosecutors in the same unit, that is an unhealthy situation. Now, I want to know whether he made that statement from a subjective point of view or objective point of view. Can he give us an example of a country that tried to do that and was not successful? If what we had is correct, the FBI, for example, has investigators and prosecutors working hand in hand. That's why they have such a high level of success. So is there an example that he can give us of a country that tried to use them both in the same unit? And failed, and also maybe came to the conclusion that such a relationship is unhealthy.
And also to add on that one, the submission from FATU and MKVA is saying the tracker method is unconstitutional. I just want him to add on that one. And the MKVA is saying it is against the law of natural justice of the DSO to have both the power to investigate and to prosecute. This must be separated.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we probably are very much in agreement as to the role that prosecutors need to play, but it's just the degree of that. If one takes and looking at models where we might propose the retention of the Scorpions, clearly if in the present model where they are under the NPA, the benefit is that it not only addresses our concerns relating to the involvement of prosecutors, but it also adds to the independence requirement in terms of our international convention. But my specific issue that you've just touched on, and that relates to the involvement of prosecutors, and maybe the Commissioner can just comment on the case of S versus Killian, which is referred to in the NPA document, that it stated that it's not a problem for prosecutors to lead, guide, or exercise oversight over an investigation, and that they will not necessarily lose their professional objectivity. Now, that's on page 22. That's a Supreme Court case, which clearly states what the law is on that issue. So I think we are all in agreement. There's no problem with involving prosecutors. My specific question as well relates to why, in terms of the bill, the court laid a very high requirement of prosecutors at the moment across the board, not only in the Scorpions, but that they have to make sure that the investigations are properly done. And in terms of the NPA Act Section 24, there's a requirement that the prosecutors need to supervise, direct and coordinate and guide all investigations. That was not included to apply to this new directorate. Could I also ask why that in terms of the bill, or do we accept that it doesn't have to apply? That is also referred to in the NPA's document on page 11. So it emphasizes the need for prosecutor involvement, whatever model we're going to achieve. Thank you.
I'll take one last question from Ms. Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. Just a separate issue, but it's also raised under the methodology section of the document, and that's the issue raised about plea bargaining. And maybe just to make the point that, I mean, plea bargaining really has been used and has existed even before the DSO was created, so it's nothing new. The one thing that was raised by the public in the public hearings that they were complaining about was that they were saying there's no consistency in terms of plea bargains, and you'll recall exactly the name of Mark Thatcher, for example, came up quite often. So my question really would be, I mean, it would be to Flip or to Johan or even to Willie, is how does one seek to get some sort of consistency or precedent when it comes to plea bargaining, and is it practical even to think that one can achieve that?
I just want to give over to Mr. Jacobs to respond. We want to add a question to respond to some. Let me start with Mr. Jacobs, then I'll come back to you.
Sure, I think I must be clear about the views on prosecutors. I think I've been a prosecutor many years ago, ever since I've been a prosecutor many years ago, if a prosecutor would phone an investigator and ask him to bring a docket, and he would read it and he would give instructions on that docket, the investigator shall do that. He must do that. And I totally recognize the role that a prosecutor has in terms of ensuring that the docket is properly investigated and to sometimes give guidance where necessary in respect of that docket. In respect of countries where the prosecution led methodology have not worked or worked or not worked, I can't really give an example. I just noticed that in the submissions that were made to the committee, there was one from a lawyer in Canada who mentioned that the prosecution-led methodology is being reviewed in Canada. I don't have any information on that whatever, but I think when the researchers look into that issue, it would be quite interesting to see whether there really is some substance in what has been mentioned there. On the issue of the plea bargaining, I think it's as with any other power, it's not really about the issue and the principle of plea bargaining. I think all of us accept that it is recognized now in law, whereas it was previously done in an informal basis. But I think it's the manner in which it is being exercised that is always open to criticism, like any other power that's being exercised. And I think there, the issue is about public interest and perceptions, maybe. And I think if specifically where it relates to Mark Thatcher, the idea, I mean, we know what happened with the Equatorial Guinea case. A lot of people are still in prison in Equatorial Guinea. They got the hard end of the sword, or the sharp end of the sword, whilst the impression is that, yes, this person who has the money and he can buy his freedom and he walk out. And I think that's that type of perception and that has to be guarded against and in the exercise, but I think maybe from the NPA side, Mr. Hofmeyer has indicated he wants to make a comment. But I think it's not about the principle of plea bargaining, but as any power that's being exercised by a public official, you stand open to criticism on how it is being exercised. And there are a lot of other examples as well where people were very angry about feelings that people are sort of protected in respect of lesser cases in order to, or in respect of very serious cases in order to obtain a conviction for a lesser conviction. Chair, I think on the secondment issue as well, it's also a question of the prosecutor, it's also a question of command and control. If you say it's prosecution-led, it very much depends on what do you read into that led. And within the context of, as the bill is written at the moment, it's within the command and control of the police. The National Commissioner will have command over the Deputy National Commissioner, the Deputy National Commissioner over the Divisional Commissioner. Now, if you say it will be prosecution-led, you should relate it then to command. Will it imply operational command as well? And I think that is where some clarity need to be established then. If you write the issue of prosecution guided or led into the bill, then you should relate it to command and control as well. Otherwise, you might get a conflict there as well. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, I had a few... I've got quite a few things that I wanted to say because I've had my hand up for a long time.
Particularly your issue relating to the objections, the constitutional objections that were raised in various submissions as to the prosecutor being involved. And then I added to that to say there's a court case that says there's no problem with that, and I'd just like to the Commissioner's confirmation of that point. And then why Section 24 of the NPA Bill was not included to make it, or does he understand that that will still apply to the new unit, and why it wasn't expressly, or is that an oversight? That Section 24 that requires prosecutors to supervise, direct, and coordinate and guide investigations before the NPA responds.
Chair, of course, that was the decision, and as I said, I think that's why I haven't responded specific to you, that the principle that a prosecutor can guide and can give directions and instructions on an investigation, I think I made it clear that principle stands. It is there, and I don't think it's an oversight that 24 has not been repealed. We recognize that a prosecutor can give direction in terms of investigations, and that in general oversees the quality and the content of dockets that's been laid before the prosecutor. And of course, when he's involved in an investigation, direction that's given there. But I think there's also a thin line between giving direction and really taking command and control of the execution of the direction. And you will find that, especially in Britain, that the prosecutor's role is limited to giving advice on how to use the legal instruments and not on executing the instruments themselves. And I think that's important, but I accept in the Kilian case that has been said, and as I said, the general principle that a prosecutor can give guidance, that is an accepted principle.
On that constitutional perspective, the Chief State Law Advisor to come in.
Thank you, Chairperson. We don't fully agree with the interpretation given by Honourable Member Swart of Killian. We see Killian located within Section 179.2 of the Constitution and within Section 205.3 of the Constitution. And I think what Commissioner Jacobs has articulated, in fact, falls in line with S versus Killian. We don't read S versus Killian as saying that the prosecutor can be involved fully in the investigation. In fact, Willie Hofmeyer and I have both had the benefit of having practiced as lawyers and having done criminal work mainly of a political nature. And prosecutors do get involved with the investigating officer to look at the docket, look at the quality of the investigation, and to suggest what else they need in order for them to carry out the prosecuting function. And that hasn't changed even in a post-apartheid society. What does concern us, and we've not looked at it very carefully, and we are trying to investigate that, is the right of an accused to a fair trial when the prosecutor is so intricately involved in the investigation. I've always been of the view that there's a thin line
and that it does border on contravening that right of a fair trial. I could share with this committee two experiences which I had under apartheid as a practicing lawyer, not as a prosecutor. One was in the Bellville Court and one was in the Oudtshoorn Court, where before the matter I went to the control prosecutor, and the control prosecutor related to me the instructions which he had had with the discussions that he had had not only with the investigating officer but with the witnesses in that matter. During my cross-examination, I put it to the accused that he in fact had discussions with the control prosecutor, who in fact asked him about a couple of things. The prosecutor objected, and I then arranged to call the control prosecutor in both instances, Belville and Oudtshoorn. I must tell you, chairperson, members, that both trials collapsed immediately. The court knew that we were now going to call the prosecutors to give evidence. In looking at the NPA back, the NPA Act, the bill initially, that was at the back of my head in relation to the DSO. It's still at the back of my head in relation to this. You see, Killian moves in the direction, of course, about talking about the involvement of the prosecutors. But the Constitutional Court hasn't definitively ruled yet on the extent to which the prosecutors can get involved. And the one thing that we are very clear on, even as the executive, while we need to combat crime effectively to reduce the unacceptably high levels of crime, we still want to ensure that the accused persons get their rights to a fair trial and do in fact obtain and receive a fair trial. Thank you.
Do you want to comment?
Chairperson, if I can respond to a few issues. I think for me the, you know, the heart of what we're talking about here is whether we are going to have a multidisciplinary approach to fight crime, or complex crime at least. And I think from my own, and I think those of people who've been in the DSO and elsewhere, it is by far the most effective way of dealing with complicated crime. And when one talks about multidisciplinary, we're not talking just about prosecutors and investigators, as Flip and others have pointed out. There are cyber forensic experts, there are forensic accountants, there are revenue people, whatever the circumstances of the case, but you're talking about a range of different professionals working together. I think where some of the models that Flip is talking about falls down is when your investigation becomes simply something for investigators to do and they call in others. I think the Scorpion model at times may have erred on the other side, that it was too much prosecutor driven and not in a sense that investigators felt they always had it, and I'm not talking about investigators within the DSO, felt that they have a sort of equal say in the decisions that are being taken. I think for me the challenge that we face here is to build an institution where we can institutionalize the multidisciplinary nature of the institution, where it's not just prosecutors who make the decision and run the show, or investigators who run the show, but where we create an environment where people really work together as a team, and to a large degree can take decisions as a team. Not that the one feels they're more important than the other. By the way, we've started talking about prosecution-driven or led investigations rather than prosecutor-driven, because the idea is to focus on a prosecution, not on the role of the prosecutor. I think when you have a multidisciplinary environment where different professionals work together, one must expect that they sometimes disagree. They all have their own strong views, they all have their professional competences, and the others may not always understand their professional competences that well. And I think that is why it is, and I can talk a little bit here from my experience at asset forfeiture and at the SIU, where we've tried to build a model where the different professions in the organizations have a more equal say in what is done, that it's not the lawyers or the investigators who simply dictate what happens and the others are there to assist or to, you know, that it's not that there's a feeling that one person on the team is there to give the instructions. So for me the challenge is how do we fashion an organization where we can institutionalize this cooperation, where we can manage the inevitable professional differences that may arise, that you manage it in a coherent fashion, in a constructive fashion, and where over time you start building the trust between the different professions and each other's capabilities. For me, that's one of the reasons why secondment, while they are a short-term solution, doesn't work very well. Because people work together on one case, then they go and work with other people on another case, or they never work together again. But it is a question of building some trust in an organization like that. And to have mechanisms within the organization to resolve the professional differences that may arise. And so I think those are, for me, important features that you need to build in. You know, simply seconding lots of people with them all still having their different chains of commands, when they disagree, it becomes very slow and cumbersome to resolve disagreements. And so for me, it's quite important that within your organization, you have senior people from the different professions who basically are there to help ensure that the differences that may arise are resolved, and start building that team spirit between the different components in the organization. So I think for me that's the vital challenge. I can't say that the DSO has got that perfectly right. I've not been in the DSO helping to manage the DSO for very long. But, you know, I think that it's got it more right than in the traditional relationship between prosecutors and investigators. So for me, that's point number one. It's just a challenge of institutionalizing a multidisciplinary environment. I think the second challenge, you know, the second issue that's been discussed here a lot is the role of prosecutors. Now, I humbly disagree with my colleague Enver here. I think that the issue of prosecutors and investigators belonging to the same organization and prosecutors being intimately involved in the investigation was litigated in Killian. In Killian, the person who did the interrogation under oath of the accused and who compelled him to answer self-incriminating questions, not by choice but because the other prosecutor became unavailable, ended up prosecuting the person as well. That person had been really involved in the details of the investigation. And the court held that it is not sufficient just the fact that it's happened. You know, if the prosecutor did something wrong, then there may be something to say, as may be the case in Enver's discussion. But the court said it's not the mere fact that the prosecutor was involved that is a problem. It is whether the prosecutor did something wrong. Then it may be a problem, and that is one that has to be dealt with. I'm not saying this is a simple process. You know, you'll know in the Sheikh case there was litigation. Billy Downer was in Mauritius on the scene where the searches were being done by the Mauritius policemen. And it's vital that he is there to ensure that they don't take documents that aren't needed, that they can get legal advice on what may be legitimate in terms of the South African search warrants that were issued or not. And in complicated cases, that is vital, because when you're doing a search, you come across privileged documents. You know, then somebody must say, be there to give advice to the people doing the actual search. It's not that the prosecutor is doing the actual search, but he's there. In some cases like that, the prosecutor may become an actual witness in the case. You know, it may be that the person who found the document died. And the prosecutor is the only one who finally can say that document was found on the scene by such a person. That prosecutor becomes a witness, he can no longer prosecute. And that is a very difficult situation that arises in this methodology, and one that one does take every precaution to avoid it. Because when your prosecutor becomes a witness, he can no longer prosecute, and you need to bring a new person into the case. So I think there are internal ways of managing this relationship to make sure that the bounds of propriety is not crossed. But you also obviously need backup plans for when people die and things like that that may happen. But I think there is far from it being, and you know, leading to possible abuse. I think the presence of prosecutors and investigators is a safeguard for accused persons. Prosecutors are officers of the court. They have an ethical obligation when they see an investigator doing something illegal, or when they become aware of something illegal being done in an investigation, to inform the court. They're not allowed to cover up or to be quiet about the matter. So, you know, it's far from being an intrusion into the rights of accused persons. It is, in fact, ensuring that the details of the investigation are being observed by somebody that is an officer of the court with certain ethical obligations. And if they don't abide by those ethical obligations, they end up in trouble as a professional. They can be struck off the roll for doing those sorts of things. It's the end of their career. So, you know, I think there's been legally, nobody has been able to cite anything here to say it's wrong for prosecutors and investigators to be in the same game. I accept that one can take a policy decision that it is undesirable, but I don't think we should confuse a policy decision with what is constitutional or what the law requires. In the UK, the Serious Fraud Office has for years and years had prosecutors and investigators working together in the same body, in the same unit, with the same chain of command. And here we've had the Serious Economic Office for Serious Economic Offences, then at CO and later the DSO. Those issues have been litigated. The courts have never said that they are problematic legally. As I said, a policy may be a different issue. Our suggestion is that if there is a policy decision, which we don't think is wise, but it may be a policy decision to say, let's not have people in the same unit, then at the minimum, I think what we should say in the legislation is to go back to the old RCO and ITCO models, where the police and prosecutors were co-located, but with the different chains of command. They still belonged to the police and to the NPA respectively, but it was clear that they were going to sit together in the same place and work on the same cases. I think the key issue here, Chairperson, is that when people sit in different offices and there are issues that need to be discussed or resolved, they have to make appointments. It takes sometimes weeks to get appointments to resolve those issues. And so the issue of co-location, I think, is for me very, very critical when we deal with these issues. I wanted just to say something on the issue of plea bargains, because it's been raised as well and referred to that the NPA to discuss. I think we will all admit that mistakes are made in plea bargains. As Flip has said, when you do work, mistakes happen. I think initially plea bargains in the NPA was very highly centralized. They all had to be signed off at a very serious level. I think they were probably decentralized too quickly after that. But the NPA has had a process over the last 6 months to review the way that plea bargains are done and approved, and that statistics are properly collected, that we can ensure a greater measure of uniformity in the use of plea bargains. I think the point that I wanted to make, maybe just more generally for the Justice Committee here, is that plea bargains work in places like the US and Canada. I think 70% of their cases are resolved by plea bargains. And that's probably important, because else the system wouldn't cut. But the plea bargains work there partly because there are clear sentencing guidelines. So sentencing guidelines means if you are person X with these circumstances, you get convicted of this offense. The law says you can get a sentence of somewhere between 12 and 18 years. You know, that the judge has the discretion to give a sentence between those two within that framework. They're not allowed to deviate from the framework. So it's a very detailed framework that has been set up. So plea bargain, you get at the bottom of the, you get the 12 years. If you don't plea bargain, you get the risk of getting the 18 years. I think the challenge in South Africa at the moment is that our justice system is not strong enough. Most people who are willing to plea bargain are only willing to plea bargain if it keeps them out of jail. If they think they have to go to jail, they'll take their chance with the prosecution and the investigation, and that's like 60% of the cases in this country, their case will fall through the cracks and they'll just walk free. So, you know, I think we have real challenges here to build capacity before we will have an effective system of plea bargaining. I think those were the major issues that I wanted to respond. Thank you, Chair.
Are there any inputs? Maybe we go down to another sub-item, which is power and function?
Some procedural issues. One is, you said you've done research already on some other model. Can you give us that research? Secondly, we can already ask to look at other models. Now, we're talking about not next week, but when the multi-party committee, subcommittee meets, we would like you to look at the, give us an overview of the UK model, the Norwegian model, since it was mentioned by the Sussman Foundation, and other models. Okay, can you do some work around it so it facilitates the modeling and other work we're going to do in the subcommittee? We might also ask the research unit to do some work in PC and to listen to our neighbors today and see what you can do. You want to say something, Steve?
Because we've also heard the NPA would have proposals as well, so I presume they'll be working together, or will the NPA also give us a model that they will propose?
Chief, sorry, just one remark briefly on this issue of the role of the prosecutors. I think we should just not lose track of the fact that once again, perceptions are very important, and we are quite clear that the fact that the DSO is currently located within the office of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, that gives rise to this perception that the prosecutors are in fact running the whole show. It would make, in our view, quite a big difference if it's either relocated to this new director within the SAPS, or even if it's a loose standing unit, but that would solve in a large degree that problem of prosecutors directing the whole show, whereas in effect, I think what is intended through methodology is the assistance, the guidance of the prosecutors, not that they're calling the shots, as is the perception at the moment.
Thanks. Is there any input? Maybe we can get into powers and functions. Christine?
These directly refer to the powers, comments about the powers contained, I think in section 16B of the SAPS Amendment Bill, which are largely a rewriting or the writing over section 28 of the NPA Act. The comments were that these are extraordinary powers and they need to be exercised cautiously. Already the court has raised various concerns about the exercise of these powers. On the other hand, the concern was raised that the right to refuse to answer questions that are self-incriminating removes any kind of weight or power to these powers. And then another concern was these powers have been given to the Crime Intelligence Division within SAPS as well.
Any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, I think we need to say that
some years ago, I think in 2002, there was a report of the South African Law Commission that was handed to the Minister of Justice, which related to the right to silence, and specifically questioning by the police. And some recommendations were made there, and also some comparative research, etc. I think firstly we need to recognize that when it comes to questioning of police, I think there really is something that we need to look at. And I think it relates to the broader issue of the criminal justice review as well. The powers in the proposed section 16B, as it was said, it is it's very much the same as those in section 28 at the moment. In respect of giving the powers also to crime intelligence, we are not really insisting on that. We've added it in there. It's not really an issue for us if there's any objection to that. There was an objection from the DSO concerned group that it doesn't make sense to say that in this bill we do not require a person to answer incriminating questions, but at the same time we give them immunity, the same as when as in section 28. I actually agree with that. I think if we need to strengthen section 28, what's section 16B, in view of the fact that incriminating questions do not need to be answered, I think the immunity part should be removed from that clause. Chair, we actually got requests from especially our commercial crime branch, because they were working very closely together with the Serious Economic Offences Unit and the predecessors of ITSEO. And they actually became accustomed to that type of working method by being able to ask people to come and bring information and to answer certain questions, etc., and especially within a commercial crime environment. As a matter of fact, those powers, we've actually submitted letters to the Minister of Justice some occasions, even before the Gampebe Commission. And we actually gave copies of those letters to the judge during the Gampebe Commission of Inquiry. And I think it's on the basis of that that the judge has made the observation in the report that where the police deal with the same type of cases that the DSO deal with, that they should have the same type of power. Now, I realize some of the criticism, and that is a difference with Section 28. Section 28, and as it's also reflected in the terrorism legislation and the Corruption Act, both Sections 22, in both of those acts, where the police is included in the Corruption and Terrorism Act, it is still required that the actual inquiry or the, I don't want to say interrogation, but the interviewing or the questioning must still be done by a prosecutor. And I think that's where this bill differs, where we provide that a police officer, be it on the rank of a director or the head of the institution, must do the questioning. Chair, I think if we need to compromise on that, I think if we can have the same dispensation that we have at the moment in terms of Section 22 of the Terrorism and the Corruption Act, I think that would also assist us. And then Section 22 actually say that when the National Director of Public Prosecutions is of the opinion that an offence has been committed, either in terms of the Terrorism Act or the Corruption Act, he might use actually the powers in Section 28 and 29 to investigate that. Now, part of the powers in the NPA Act is that he might designate persons to assist him. And then in the definition part of Section 22, they say that special investigator also include a police official. In other words, a police official can also go to a, but in that case it's not to the director of, it's to a director of public prosecutions and not the NPA himself. So if we can have the possibility to actually approach a director of public prosecutions in terms of all the offences that's being investigated in terms of the mandate of this DPCI, to exercise those same type of powers, I think that would also, it will give us more or less the same mechanism, but with the assurance that it will be a director of public prosecutions or a person designated by him who will do the questioning. But, Chair, I must also say that the way in which the two bills speak to each other, we will actually lose the powers that we have at the moment in terms of Section 22 of the Terrorism and Corruption Act, because we are now deleting all references to investigating special investigator. In other words, the wording in Section 22 of the Terrorism and Corruption Act becomes sort of meaningless. So whatever we do, we need to ensure that we don't lose what we already have in terms of other legislation. But then I can, and once again, we can look at the gap that is presently in legislation. The SAPs do have that power, be it through the DPP in the Corruption Act. We do have it in terms of the Terrorism Act. But very interesting, if you look at Section 72 of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, if you look at the whole Prevention of Organized Crime Act, there's actually no powers written in for the police. And I think that is really something we need to address. That, as I say, at the very least, that the SAPs be able, in terms of not only corruption and terrorism, but also organized crime, have the ability to do that type of questioning which is allowed in terms of Section 28. Thanks.
Thanks.
Any
input?
Oh,
NPA?
I think our main concern here is, you know, I think we are fully in agreement that SAPs should have access to such powers. That's, you know, I think we've supported that view over many years. The issue really is these are draconian powers, and the courts have said these powers are constitutional, but the safeguards that surround the powers are the critical issue. And I think the critical safeguard at the moment has been that those powers are only exercised under a sort of direct authority of a director of public prosecution, who is a senior legal person. It's a person directly appointed by the president. So I think we could talk to Flip. I'm sure we can come to an agreement on how to structure that. I don't think that's an issue. It's only a question that we shouldn't lose some of the safeguards that are in the law at the moment. Because I think the courts have clearly, the constitutional court has clearly signified an uneasiness with the potential to abuse this power. And I think any lessening of the safeguards we would have to look at. I think we may even want to suggest some strengthening of the safeguards. At the moment there isn't a Concord decision on this. If you'll remember, Mr. Sheikh took this power, this issue, to the Constitutional Court. His lawyers cited the wrong section, so the Concord decided not to hear the issue on a technicality. But they did express some reservations, and I think those reservations are really what informs our concerns here. Perhaps what I would like to say, and I think we should discuss this some more as well, but, you know, our suggestion, if there's a separation of prosecutors from the new unit, we would in fact propose that the prosecution, that we should, in the same way as that in the Police Act there's a special unit set up, that in the prosecution in the NPA Act we should transfer the cases, the powers, into a investigating directorate framework that there is at the moment. And that would be the investigating directorate that works with this new unit within the SAPS. So that you would, you know, in that way set up a way of how the integrated methodology is going to work in practice. I think one of the advantages of that would be that at the moment, the NPA is structured essentially provincially. The new unit, I think, which is an innovation in SAPS as well, will be structured nationally. And one would need an equivalent structure in the NPA to ensure that we work together seamlessly in the way that I think we would all like to do. So I think there are a couple of options to explore here, and perhaps we should go away and just try and find out the best way. I don't think it's a particularly sort of contentious issue. But I think the other safeguard I should just mention that the courts are willing to enforce those powers in cases that are serious. I don't think they're going to countenance it in the normal run-of-the-mill kind of case. I think that's why so far those powers have only been extended in the areas of organized crime, serious economic crime, and later to corruption and terrorism offenses. It's not, you can't, don't want to extend the use of these powers to offenses where they're not really necessary, where there's not a compelling case. Else you will again become vulnerable to a constitutional attack.
That's I think a point that we need to make, Commissioner Jacobs, as well, is that I don't believe. I think the route it's going to take is the one of the terrorism bill. That's my feeling about it, because I honestly don't believe, Jefferson, that saying that the person must be a director in SAPS who do the interrogation or whatever you want to call it is a safeguard. A person's rank is not, I believe, the sole qualification for that person to be able to do it. I mean, in our oversight, we know that many of our problems lie exactly at that level. And, it's, you know, I don't believe that's sufficient safeguard. So my feeling, I would support a view where we actually look at the anti-terror legislation and approach in order to this one.
Honourable Spanian?
Yeah, Koshi, I wanted just to say those powers I think should be included, because it will be in line with the intention to say this structure that has been created has an intention to enhance the fight against organized crime and corruption. Those functions are needed.
And then the additions, Honourable Chubet.
Thank you, Chair. It's not clear to me whether if a new unit is placed under the police, whether it retains the general powers it has under the Police Act, and whether this is additional power.
Are there any comments? Honourable Job? Nothing.
No, Jefferson, I think I understand what Mr. Swanier is saying. Again, issue transfer. You know, I'm trying to say, give me everything, and I will tell you when it's wrong. If I don't come back to tell you what happened. In other words, they should put check and balances in this matter. You cannot just give a blanket all powers and then you say, I'm giving you everything, and then you run with it. There should be check and balances somewhere, somehow. I agree with what you're saying, but at the end of the day, we should know exactly where are the check and balances on the matter.
I wanted to say with safeguards, but can I omit it with safeguards?
Thank you, ma'am. On the specific question of Oliver, Mr. Youpass, there were concerns expressed by the DSO concern group that it seems as if this body will be a public entity. And it seems as if it will only have the powers in the building, in other words, not the normal police powers. Clearly, the intention was to create it as a structure within the SAPS. And the members that will be transferred to SAPS will be SAPS members. They will be transferred as SAPS members. I took the issue up with the state law advisors, and we feel we need to make it clear, very clear from the bill, that these members will have all the powers of police officials as well. So I think it's an issue that we need to flag just to make doubly sure of that. So the provision of Section 16B is actually intended as an additional power to all the police powers that they already have. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks. This is us from the Gala on Business as Usual. You are welcome.
Just one thing, there is a constitutional court challenge, that's right, Section 28. Is that true or not? Where is that process, and what is the nature of the challenge? What is the argument there?
Chair, there's been a few challenges over the years, from the late 90s, because the old Office for Serious Economic Offences had the same powers as we're talking about. And I think, in general, the law has survived those challenges. mistake case, but as I said, it was in a context where the court really said we're not hearing the case, was whether there should not be an independent legal person who presides over the questioning. I think the concern that the court has is that even though a DPP level person has to approve the interview, that it can be conducted by an investigator or a junior lawyer, and the person being interviewed, the accused, may raise a legal point. He may say, even though I'm compelled to answer self-incriminating questions, this is an issue of marital privilege. And who's going to decide now whether he is raising the right legal issue there or not? So I think the court was sort of signaling in a sense that one may want to consider that even whoever conducts the interview, that one has some sort of safeguard about who presides, the seniority of a person who is present there to decide about legal issues that may be raised, so that the person isn't just bludgeoned or compelled into answering questions, even though he or she may be raising legitimate legal issues that may just not be misunderstood by the person questioning them. So I think that is the only real sense of vulnerability in the law as it is written now. The sense that it's saying a senior person must authorize, but it's unclear about who actually conducts the interview, and so it may be delegated down to a relatively junior level.
I'm talking about related to the mass media references to, maybe I've got it wrong, they said Maharaj is taking the matter to court.
There is a challenge by Mr. Maharaj.
Yeah, it's
in the High Court. It's not.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
So it's still lying there.
Yeah. And when are they going to finalize their decision?
I don't think it's even progressed to be close to a hearing, but I will try and find out what the current state
is. And what is the basis of the...
I think it's similar to the argument raised in the Sheikh matter, that it is unconstitutional in that it infringes on people's rights, their inadequate safeguards. But we can try and get you some of the details of the argument.
Are there any...
Sorry, Chair, maybe I can just mention that in our submission from pages 90 onwards, we deal with some of the cases, the Park Ross matter, the Hyundai matter, Sheikh, and the company case called Select Credit Control, where these issues have been argued, and they're short summaries of all those judgments.
Any comment? I propose we go to coordination and oversight. Christian?
I want to go into the details, but you will see in our submission there is sections where the present bill does not read well, because the DSO model at the moment is that people do not have general police powers. They in fact have no powers. They only have powers in a particular case which has been declared and on which they are designated. Now, a number of those provisions are taken over just as they are into the SAPS bill. And I think that's what creates part of the confusion here, that if people have a general power, they don't need to be given power in relation to a specific case, as is in the DSO model at the moment. So there are parts which we highlight in our submission. I think it's more a technical exercise, but that would have to be clarified there about whether the members of this new organization have general powers or whether they only have powers once they are involved in a particular case.
Yeah, some outstanding questions. The Susan Foundation says the power of search and seizure will weaken 4.2 sub A in SAPS. And what does that mean? And what's your response?
Chair, I think that he reflects on the fact that it's only Section 28 that is written. implicated in the bill, and not Section 29, which deals with search and seizure. But if you look at Section 29 of the NPA Act, it actually also requires that you actually approach a judge for a warrant. And we have search and seizure powers, I mean, I think much wider than many, in the sense, even in the SAPS Act, of cordoning off an area if it's necessary and search, and in the search and seizure provisions in the Terrorism Act, for example, and the normal Criminal Procedure Act provision. So I think from our side, we didn't see a need to replicate the provisions of Section 29 as well. And it wouldn't have helped us very much because we can't exercise those powers without a warrant. We actually also need to get the warrant to exercise.
There's agreement on that, that we can remove this. It's really not a strong argument. Okay, fine, we dismiss that then.
Sorry, if I can just raise one issue. I think one of the provisions in the NPA Act is that it can approach a judge for a warrant, which I think the Criminal Procedure Act does not provide for. And I think that has been important in big cases, complex cases, where you really want to have a judicial officer who's going to apply their mind very, very carefully to the warrant, knowing that it's going to be challenged afterwards. I know in normal cases, judges are a bit reluctant to hear warrant applications, and it has been useful, I think, for the law to say specifically that they may be approached for a warrant.
Sorry, Chair. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, from Mr. Hoffmeyer. Indeed, it is true, Chair. With normal warrants, you need to go to the magistrate of the district to obtain the warrant. So if you have a case which is over a lot of, say, within a number of provinces or a number of places in a province, you actually need to go to every magistrate, and that actually creates a security risk as well. We had some cases where you actually cannot really go to a specific magistrate because there are some sensitivities. And I think we should actually flag that for power for the police to approach a judge where you need it in terms of a broader investigation over a number of districts.
What are we finalizing? Are we going to flag it or what is it now? I just want to hear properly. What is the Commissioner's table saying? We're going to flag it or is he coming up with a proposal or something?
Chair, I'm proposing that we flag this issue to actually look at the mechanism that we can insert in the Act for the police or for this unit to apply for a warrant to a judge. So I don't have a specific proposal, but we should definitely work on some wording on that. Thanks, Chair.
On coordination oversight, so can I go ahead?
Just by honourable saying his hunger, I don't know whether it's that basic, but never brought it to my attention. Before 1 o'clock now, we can go see. Suggestions about the kind of oversight body that should be formed to ensure operational cooperation and coordination. There's also concerns around executive oversight. There are lots of suggestions about the need for a ministerial coordinating committee, but there's also a counter argument that the FCC never worked and never will work. Then with regard to the forum structure that's in the bill, there's concerns about the vagueness of this. There's who will sit on the forum and how it will operate. And yeah, definitely a need for a formal institutionalized cooperation and information sharing among stakeholders. Thank you.
Are there any comments, maybe?
Thank you, Chair. Of course, the bill does not reflect a specifically a ministerial coordinating committee, but rather the more informal forum that you suggested there. Chair, I think from our side, we and I think if you can go even further to Hampepe, also recommendations regarding a on a more operational level, a committee as well. Chair, on an operational level, we really see a problem for committees to sort of to direct and control this kind of operation, and that's where we think that the forum, which will be more than a policy oversight type of role, and which may include more role players than only certain ministers, as is present in Section 31, will be a more useful instrument to give direction to and improve coordination between different institutions. On the operational level, Chair, maybe from the police perspective, we are quite used to coordinating mechanisms. If you look at big events that were organized, and even the soccer 2010 that's being organized now, there are so many interdepartmental cooperation mechanisms, the Joints Committee, and within the JCPS structure, and with intelligence, and all the departments that we as police work together with. And on a daily basis, not only with big events, but with investigations, with all the issues that SAPS is involved with, we are used to those coordinating mechanisms, and we deem them sufficient also for purposes of coordinating these. The SAPS is part of the NICOC structures, is part of the intelligence structures. We are part of the coordination of intelligence through NICOC and with NIA and the Secret Service. And as I said, there are so many operational areas where the SAPS do have mechanisms in order to coordinate investigations and operations that we feel that on the operational level, there's not a requirement for a committee. And that we feel that this broader forum that is proposed should be sufficient to provide for guidelines in terms of cooperation within different institutions. Thanks.
If I understand the tenor of the discussions we are having, it seems to me whether people support or don't support this company is neither here nor there right now, but the issue is simply this, that you say on the one hand that there are challenges in securing cooperation. On the other hand, you say you don't need any more clearer provisions of the bill to ensure cooperation. I think, can we agree that that what we have in the DPCI is really inadequate? We need greater cooperation. In fact, if anything, from what we can gather, even after the Computer Commission enjoined the Ministerial Coordinating Committee to meet, our sense is as Parliament that it hardly met. And so if anything, we would say, no, we want far more explicit provisions for coordination. Secondly, I think we don't need to have any less discussion about that. The provisions you have here are weak. Is anybody disagreeing with that? No, so we're not asking, we're not having an endless debate. We're informing you we think they're weak. We're informing you to start improving on it. We haven't got the time to waste. It's really pathetic, frankly. Secondly, when we talk of coordination oversight, we must also talk about oversight of Parliament. You see, those of you who want the scorpions to be retained, I think you should be very clear. I think that there's a substantial degree of consensus among significant stakeholders in this Parliament and in the wider society that to some or other measure, wittingly or unwittingly, the scorpions played a role beyond its mandate and intervened in politics in a way they were never mandated to. We might disagree on the extent to which it happened, but I think it's going to be very, very weak, especially for those of you wanting the scorpions to be retained, to argue no such thing happened. What we might want to agree on is the extent to which it happened. What we might want to disagree on, sorry, the extent to which it happened, and whether, after all, it's not a norm almost in democracy, that state institutions are, in some or other measure, used by politicians, especially those in the majority parties, to further narrow party political purposes. You see, see, the questions might be raised about both George Bush, President George Bush, and Tony Blair in respect of the war in Iraq. So we might say, look, what happened in the case of the Scorpions was not legal, was not correct, but hey, these sort of things happen in most such institutions, the similar institutions elsewhere. We might want to argue that, we might want to argue that, but let's agree that it's not credible to say they were sort of whole agents. Also, this very parliament, with all parties, not least the DA supporting it, in a joint intelligence committee report said that in the Brown-Bowl report, that the Scorpions exceeded their mandate. All of us, whatever party we came from. So I really think it's not going to be credible for those of you on the Scorpions to argue, no, the Scorpions did nothing wrong. It's not going to work. What we should agree to disagree on is the extent to which they played a political role which they were not mandated to. Which brings us back to this question. If we want to avoid this institution being manipulated by some or other party for political purposes, how can we have some provisions in the bill that prevent what happened with the Scorpions happening again? Now, it'll either have to apply to the Scorpions if you want to do it, so can you, we challenge those of you who want the Scorpions to be in, to tell us how you're going to prevent this from happening. Or if you think it didn't happen, don't you think we should have provisions given that many, many people, especially from the majority party, think it did happen? How can we ensure that in the law we deal with that perception, that there it is? The second point, so in other words, I think the second point that this raises is the role of Parliament. You see, the ultimate authority is Parliament. And we must think, whether it's the DSO and or some other model, we must think of how we put in the law provisions to ensure accountability. Now, it may well be that some will argue that when it comes to organized crime and corruption, and this very stakeholders here from the SAPS and DSO have told us, they even want to brief us, not just in an open committee about the nature of organized crime in South Africa, but they want a closed session, which implies that there are sensitivities entailed. Well, whatever the form of accountability, we might want to think of two types of accountability. One is they account to Parliament in an open session like this committee, but they also account to parliamentary committees, the SAPS committee, that's the route we're taking, in a closed committee meeting, like the JSCI does it. But I really feel what's acutely lacking in this bill is Parliament's oversight over either the Scorpions if we're going to continue or the new model that we go for.
Are there any inputs, Member Justice?
Thanks, Jane, thanks.
MPA?
Jane, can I just say I agree wholeheartedly with the suggestion. I think, as I said yesterday, that it's inevitable that allegations are going to be made of this nature, and without necessarily accepting that allegations are true, I think it is vital that we have mechanisms that can deal with allegations and say yes, it's true, or yes, it is, and be empowered to take appropriate action, or to say no, the allegations are not true. I think that's the real weakness in what we have at the moment, that there's not that sort of effective oversight body.
Thank you, Chair. I want to agree with that, Chair. And I mean, Mr. Karim just said, but he's so involved with the women now, he doesn't hear what I say, that he said that we all agree that the Scorpions did some illegal...
No, I didn't say that. It will not be credible to argue. It will not be credible to argue that... I'm not saying you can't hold a view. It will not be credible to argue that the Scorpions were totally innocent. What we might want to do is agree to disagree about the extent to which the Scorpions played a role in politics that had nothing to do with them. And I reminded you that I don't know if the AFF supported that, but the Brown-Bowl report, for what it's worth, says that. That's what I'm saying. I'm
okay, saying now I can understand why journalists interpreted it differently. Because he specifically used the word illegal. He said that there were certain
clarify, I would well have used the word illegal,
yeah,
but I'm simply saying that we don't have to agree. What we have to agree on is they play some role and they agree to disagree on the extent to which it happened. On the issue of illegal, that's fine. So no journalist is correct to misrepresent me, or anybody,
okay,
especially when they have a tape recording.
Well, everybody can misinterpret something that somebody said, but let's keep stay with that. Jefferson, what I want to say that is, and it's actually an important point, to say that we mustn't have institutions and structures that can be misused for political ends. But that's not that easy. Because, you know, it's like democracy. We say democracy is the people rule. But the moment an election has taken place, there's a majority party, then we still say it's democracy, whether they follow the policies or whatever they told the voters, it's something different. And I would say that there's only actually one control, and that is to have specific issues in certain bills or acts to see whether an organ of the state complies to the rules of that specific act. And I mean, the moment a structure misuses certain powers, then you've got the law to say, but you are misused now. So it's not that easy to say that we must get the model. The model is that we must ensure that the legislation is such that those powers cannot not be misused for political ends. And we must always remember that, I mean, the governing party is always in a position to misuse. I mean, they can misuse the South African National Defence Force, they can use the police, I mean, they can decide this weekend they're going to use the police to come and arrest me to find something wrong in my house or something like that, you understand? So, we must just bear in mind, it's very difficult to get a situation where you say that you will never get the situation in any organ of state where it's not possible to misuse it for political ends.
Chair, I failed to understand, maybe I'm switched off because it's lunchtime, but I failed to understand what this is contributing to as a problem. Yes, it's difficult, but that's what we need to strive to. And I think that's the point that the chairperson makes. We need to put in this legislation to our best abilities as a collective here, those measures that will make sure that it is accountable to whomever and to whatever. We need to strive towards that.
Thank you. I just want to follow the okay chair about the parliament. We as parliament always get towards the end of towards the tail of everything, most of the time. Now, you say that in oversight, we must be careful that we mustn't leave parliament aside and so on. Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea where? Because we always get towards the end of the when things have already happened and so on and so forth. Mokwanese, please, Yakuluma Rusha.
The question is directed to the chapter.
No, basically, look, there's a simple answer. Firstly, in reply to Pete, actually, there's no disagreement. I said to you that maybe one has to argue in rationalization for the scorpions that this happens everywhere. I referred to the example of George Bush and Tony Blair, the war on Iraq, as an example. I mean, it's obvious that they tweet, to put it mildly, the intelligence information to rationalize the war. Now, what am I going to say? That happens in all democracies, including Sweden. But at the same time, given our specific experience in South Africa with the DSO, and given the crisis we're currently facing, we are saying that we need to put provisions in the bill to avoid, to the extent possible, political manipulation. But we accept what you say. Now, to read with respond to Baba and Global, what we're simply saying is that I think the point he's making is that we get the annual reports late in September in terms of the PFMA, the annual reports of NPA, DSO, and so on. And then what happens is, he's right, we spend the last 4 to 6 weeks quickly looking at the annual reports, and often our committees have got too many reports to deal with at the same time. So in this bill, we might want of dealing with it, that you don't just wait for the annual report. We might want to put in further provisions. If they are seeking to do certain things, they must define a policy framework, which policy framework must be subjected to approval by Parliament. So we've done those sorts of things, and we can insert it into the bill. Checks and balances, I think, is the word that's used. So, in short, I think we should start looking, Commissioner Johan, at ways that we do this.
Well, I propose that maybe we break for lunch and come back at 2 o'clock.
Now, can I just raise a procedural matter? The ANC study group, if Comrade Bulalani, it was his idea, the ANC study group didn't come back at 10 to 2 because we have an outstanding matter that we need to tie up. So we come from 10 to 2 to 2, and we start the meeting at 2, and we try to finish shortly after 3.